It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret will be back Monday. Coming up later in the program, we'll check in with a political scientist about what we can expect from our federal and state government in 2014. First, it's the time of year when the nights are long. It's perfect for stargazing as long as it's not too cold out there. But just how much of the sky are we really seeing? Back in July, we spoke to Paul Bogard. He's the author of The End of Night, Searching for Darkness in the Age of Artificial Light. Paul's worried about light pollution, that it is blocking out the darkness and it's hampering our enjoyment of the night sky, but also having some serious consequences of our health and well-being. And while lights can be a sign of hustle and bustle, I began the interview by asking him what all these lights are costing us.
Well, they are kind of exciting, and one of the things I say again and again in the book is that light itself is not the problem. Light is wonderful. It's light at night. It's a miracle, but we're using so much of it now, much more than we really need to, and it's costing us in many ways. We're wasting a whole lot of energy and money, for one thing. We're losing or have lost a view of the stars, of the heavens, and it's impacting our physical, mental, and spiritual health and the health of the environment that we depend on.
So you've been watching this and tracking this for your book. What is the evidence out there that darkness is going away?
Well, the simple evidence is just to walk out your front door and look and see what you see, which probably is a lot of light, and a lot of light that's shining straight into your eyes because it's coming from fixtures that are unshielded, and so they're casting glare. Or to look up at the sky and notice that you're hardly seeing any stars at all if you're living in a Western city, in Western Europe or North America. And so there's that first-hand evidence, but then there's also evidence that astronomers have come up with that show the true spread of artificial light at night in such that it covers the whole east of the Mississippi now. There's really no place that we could say is untouched by artificial light.
East of the Mississippi, there's no place that's untouched, really.
That's what they say, and of course, I'm not talking about dark places like down in the basement or something like that. And on a cloudy night out in the woods, it's going to be pretty darn dark. But on a clear night, if you're just going out to look at the stars in your backyard, you're not seeing a natural night sky.
Is there a way to measure just how dark it is? How much light pollution there is, in other words?
Well, there are some ways. There are meters that folks use to gauge the light in the sky. But one of the most useful gauges that I've found is called the Bortle scale. This was a scale of darkness that was developed by an amateur astronomer in northern upstate New York. And he ranked levels of darkness from 9 down to 1, 9 being our brightest places and 1 being our darkest places. And so I borrowed the idea of the scale from my table of contents, and I have 9 chapters, and I start in chapter 9 and work my way down to chapter 1. So I start the book in Las Vegas, end up in some real dark places. And one of the things that really stands out to me about this, this scale of darkness is that most Americans live most of their lives in the levels of about 5 and up, so 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Most of us just only rarely or even never experience darkness that would be in those levels of 4, 3, 2, and certainly 1.
Well, what about you? Did you find some of those darkest places?
I did. I had some really wonderful experiences, again, mostly out west, and especially in some of the national parks. The National Park Service now has a night sky team that's going around and measuring levels of darkness, and the National Park Service is now seeing the preservation of darkness in the parks as part of their mission, which I think is really pretty wonderful.
So for a lot of us, you know, maybe there's this innate primate thing that if things get too dark, we get kind of scared. So what is it that you find so, you know, wonderful and mysterious about these dark places?
Well, I have to admit, first off, that I'm one of those people who gets a little afraid of the dark. It's I know it's a little ironic. The guy that wrote the book about darkness would admit to being a little afraid of the dark. But I think that's totally natural. I think that's part of being human. But you know, what is also and has always been part of the human experience is this experience of walking out at night and coming face to face with the universe. And we've really more or less lost that experience, and it impacts us in ways that I think a lot of folks haven't really spent much time thinking about. So, you know, for generations and generations, this experience of walking out at night and seeing a real night sky has inspired artwork, certainly. It's inspired religion, wonder, awe, and a real sense of our place, not only in the universe, but our place here on Earth. You know, coming face to face with all those stars can make you feel pretty small, but I think for me, it also makes me feel large in the sense of understanding how wonderful and beautiful this world is, and how important it is that our role is in taking care of this world.
Now, you and I chatted by phone a couple of weeks ago, and you told me that you'd spent some time in Wisconsin and up on Madeline Island, which is one of my favorite places to be and where I've seen incredible night skies, at least to my mind. How does Madeline Island shape up in the darkness meter for you?
Madeline is probably going to be right in that three level, I would say. I was really lucky to spend 3 years teaching up at Northland College in Ashland. And I remember in my job interview, the committee was extolling the virtues of the darkness in that area as a way of enticing me to come up and work there. So, yeah, I mean, there are real beautiful areas of darkness left in Wisconsin. And if you go across the border to the Boundary Waters in Minnesota, you can find some real beautiful darkness. But just everywhere is feeling the impact of artificial light. I grew up in Minneapolis, and my family has a cabin in northern Minnesota. So when I was a kid, we had real darkness. We had probably what would rank about a 3 or even a 2 on that Bortle scale I was talking about, where you'd stand on the end of the dock and watch satellites pass through these just sugary spreads of stars, just amazing numbers of stars. And, you know, I go back there now and it's still dark and it's still beautiful, but I can tell it's not the same. I can tell there's light on the horizon and light in the sky from the surrounding towns.
Wow. Sugary spreads of stars. Now, that's something everybody's got to want to see. I know. I mean, how do you know if you're seeing, you know, because most of us can look up and say, yeah, there's a few stars, but how can we tell when we're really not seeing the full view?
Well, I talked to a number of astronomers, mostly, and dark sky advocates who gave me a few rubrics for that. I remember Bob Berman, a astronomy writer in upstate New York, who said, he really thinks it takes about 450 individual stars for us to have that experience of kind of, wow, like this is something amazing. To put that in perspective, in many American and really cities all over the world, you walk out at night, you're probably lucky to see about 25 individual stars. And the human eye, which is really, I don't know if people understand how remarkable the eye is in terms of seeing at night. On a normal natural night, we ought to be able to see about 2,500 individual stars. So again, Berman put this number at about 450 as the moment when you're kind of like, oh my gosh, you know, this is amazing.
That's the wow number.
Yeah, that is the wow number, at least for him. And I would just say a lot of folks would just say, if you can see the Milky Way arcing overhead, that's, you know, that's when you're going to be filled with wonder and kind of realize what you're missing the rest of your life.
That's Paul Bogard, author of The End of Night. We've got the second half of the interview coming up in just a few moments. We're talking darkness this hour and the way that our modern, brightly lit lifestyle is threatening our view of the sky and our health. Our guest is Paul Bogor, the author of The End of Night. And, Paul, before we get to the health stuff, let's take a call next. We have Monica in Greenfield. Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call and for this program. I feel very strongly about the need of having darkness at night, but the reason for when we sleep. But the reason for my call is because this program reminds me of the darkest place that I have been at, which is my hometown. I grew up in central Mexico, right between Mexico City and the border with the United States. Mm. And the second time I went back home, this place is a mile and a half above the level of the sea. And growing up, people used to tell me that Zacatecas, my hometown, had the darkest blue sky ever. Well, this day that I came back home, it was in the middle of the night. It was probably around 2 in the morning. And I came out of the plane and into the open airport, and I looked up at the sky, and I started crying and weeping because I really got that feeling that this is so beautiful. And we used to see the Milky Way from there.
Mm. Mm. You describe it beautifully. Paul, have you been in that area?
I haven't, actually, but hearing that, I would love to go.
Oh, thank you so much for that call. We appreciate that. And another one from Anne. Anne is calling from Harbor Springs, Michigan. Hi there, Anne.
Hi. I lived in California for about 11 years, between 91 and 2002. And I used to go camping and go to different places. And at some point, I went to the Death Valley Desert. And I believe that's where it was that at night when I looked up and I saw how many stars could be seen, how many stars were in the sky, I couldn't believe that I had lived this long and never known that I could, that could be seen. And I believe it was the Death Valley Desert. I went to a lot of places. But I wonder, aren't there must still be places in the West where you can go and see that.
Well, you described that wonderfully, too. I've never been there, but I think, Paul, that you've been out that way.
I have, actually. I'm smiling as I'm hearing your guest, your caller, talk about Death Valley, because I had one of the most wonderful experiences during my research, and it made it into the book, of being in Death Valley. Just a phenomenal place at night. And one of the things I think about when I think of Death Valley is, you know, our eyes, as I mentioned earlier, are really quite amazing in terms of their ability to see at night, but you have to give them time. And so I'd had the experience of being out at night for about 10 minutes and seeing a difference, and then maybe about 45 minutes and seeing a difference. But I tell you, after about 3 hours in Death Valley, it was almost like if you've ever gone to the eye doctor and he's trying or she's trying to get the your prescription right, and they're kind of saying, is that better? Is that better? Is mm-hmm. that better? And all of a sudden they strike that one where everything is crystal clear. It's almost like after 3 hours, the sky just developed in front of my eyes, and I felt like I was seeing stars that I hadn't seen before, and that was pretty amazing.
That does sound amazing. And that was in Death Valley, you said.
In Death Valley, which is, again, you know, obviously a national park, a place that you can relatively easily get to. I should say also that this night in Death Valley, as wonderful as it was, I could also see on the horizon the glow of Las Vegas. And so there even wouldn't be considered, as we were talking about earlier, a class one darkness, because that class one would be no evidence of artificial light.
Ah, Las Vegas, the brightest place. Paul, what are you doing there?
I don't know. It's it's a little ironic. I know that. So,
okay, let's take in one more call. Doug in Perry. Hi, Doug.
Hi, I'm calling from the town of Perry in Dane County, Wisconsin. And just like to let you know that here in the town, if you sit in a lawn chair at night and look up, we can easily count over 1,000 stars right off the bat, see the Milky Way, and watch the International Space Station going by, even though we're only a few minutes from the capital in Wisconsin here. And one of the reasons is, and this is the reason for my call, is in our town we passed a dark sky ordinance. And that ordinance requires people to have shielded lights and outdoor lights, particularly dusk-to-dawn lights. And if you have an old light that stops working or finally fails or whatever, the new one that you replace it with has to be shielded. And if anyone wants to try their hand at getting an ordinance passed like that in their town, they can just come to the Town of Perry website. You can just look it up on the web and scroll down to ordinances, and you'll see the dark sky ordinance right there.
All right, interesting. Thank you so much for bringing that up, Doug. And Paul, can you speak to that? Is that a growing trend, these dark sky ordinances, which is, I'm assuming are efforts to lid the lights at night?
Yeah, what a great call. It's really wonderful to hear that. Another place you can go if you're interested is the International Dark Sky Association. That's darksky.org. They can give you a lot of information about these lighting ordinances. And, you know, listening to that call reminds me of something I come back to a lot in the book and when I'm talking with folks about this, which is, you know, this is a problem. I'm speaking of light pollution that we can readily address. It's not to say that it's simple or that it'll just be overnight, right? But it is something that we can tackle. And that gives me a real sense of hope and purpose. Not that I'm not dealing with some of these other huge problems that are so important to our world, but light pollution is something that we can do something about.
Now, I want to get to some of the health costs of darkness. Now, there's the wonder factor, which we've been hearing about, and you know, you could just look at that alone, and that would be enough, I think, to make people care. But there are also health costs associated with the lack of darkness, aren't there?
There are, and I think you know, it was important for me in the book to make sure that it's not just a book of astronomy. It's not just a book about the night sky. It really is a book about how important night is and how important darkness is. And one of the reasons, one of the real important reasons that darkness is vital is that we need it for health, for our physical, mental, spiritual health. And just a way to think about it is just that all life on Earth evolved in bright days and dark nights, and we need both for optimal health. So the effect on the human body, you know, our body has never evolved to adjust to all the light that we have in the night right now. And so this is a completely unnatural experience. And what we're doing now is kind of an enormous ongoing experiment. We're just beginning to get some of the results from. And what we're finding is that all this light at night is disrupting our sleep. It's confusing our body's circadian rhythms, and it's impeding the production of the hormone melatonin. And this has been linked to the development of cancer in our bodies. So, so much so that the World Health Organization now classifies night shift work as a probable carcinogen. And with 20% of Americans and Europeans working at night, part of the time at least, this is becoming a real problem.
So does that mean we should do what we can? If we can't have total darkness in our cities, we should be buying light-blocking shades and things like that?
Yeah, and you know, again, the science is just emerging on this. But one of the crucial things researchers are trying to find out now is just how much light affects us. So you know, is light coming in from a streetlight enough? Is light coming in under your bedroom door enough to cause some of these problems? Really, you know, what's one of the earlier callers spoke to this, but we can do so much. To move in the right direction, both for bringing back the night sky and for protecting our health by shielding our lights and not letting all that light just kind of spray all over the place.
And how hard is that to do in your experience as cities? You know, we heard from our caller there in Perry, Wisconsin. How hard is it to get the city on board with things like this?
Well, I won't, you know, lie and say it's simple or easy, but there have been a number of towns and cities, both in the U.S. and Europe, that have had good success with that. Much of the time, it has more to do with energy costs. When folks start to realize how much money, light, energy we're wasting, and how much less light you can use when you shield these lights or even turn the lights off part of the night. That seems to be the real motivator for a lot of places to have some of these dark sky ordinances.
And what about our obsession with our, you know, our electronic gadgets, our iPads and our iPhones? A lot of people wind down now by watching a screen, a TV or an iPad. Is that interfering, do you think?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think researchers are really trying to focus on because of the ubiquitous nature of those screens. And the thing about those screens is that they produce a blue light, which has been shown to kind of affect our bodies the most. If you think about how we evolved, our body evolved to respond to blue light, that is to wake up when the sky is blue, when that light came out. And so if you think about, you know, you're lying in bed reading on your iPad or looking at your computer or watching television, that light is telling your body to wake up. And so that's, you know, obviously kind of the opposite direction of what we're going to want our bodies to be doing when we go to sleep.
Well, Paul, it's been so wonderful to talk to you about this. Thank you for helping us think about the night sky and the stars again.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.